It's good to see you. Good to be with you. I know we're missing a lot of people today. My wife and daughter are out of town at my going to see my in-laws, and so it's yet another Sunday. It pays to be a preacher. You just never know what you're going to get out of. I feel pretty safe in saying they're not watching this, so if it ever gets back to them, I'm denying it. But no, they're celebrating my mother-in-law's birthday, and so I know Jonathan's. We're both batching it. We were talking about that just a little bit ago. It's good to be together with family, whatever the circumstances might be. How many of you are familiar with Marie Kondo's Tidying Up series on Netflix? How many of you are familiar with that? Okay, we got a lot of explaining to do. Okay, so those of you who hadn't heard, Marie Kondo is like this go-to guru for decluttering your home and organizing your home, how to do everything, so make sure everything's nice and neat and clean. So she goes through like how to fold and store your shirts, right? I mean, my drawer does not look like that. Right, and she does. So my daughter, by the way, has picked up on this. And if ever she folds the laundry that includes mine, I get jeans that are like a nice, neat little package, and socks that are like folded in on themselves in this perfect way, and the shirt, everything is like folded in this nice, neat way. But it's not just like how to fold your clothes. It's also how to organize like your closet. And get rid of all the things you don't really need or don't really enjoy. And so she'll go through each thing and she'll say, you know, does it spark joy? That's her go-to phrase. It's like, do you like this? Does this spark joy? And you're like, I just got that for Christmas and I feel like obligated to keep it. And she's like, gone. You know, I mean, and next thing you know, your closet is pared down. You've gotten rid of shoes and handbags and shirts and suits and all this stuff, and it goes beyond just even that. She goes like into your pantry, and she organizes everything in your pantry, and like, you know, gets these clear containers. I mean, she is a big proponent of Tupperware, and it is like all nice and neat. My pantry doesn't look like that. I mean, where is the, you know, 5-year-old can of soup that's slightly bloated in the back? That's what I want to know. She does this for all these different aspects of your home, and it's really amazing. But recently, and this has been going on for a while, she's written a book which led to this Netflix series, and she gets interviewed and writes, and she does all this stuff. She's all about decluttering life. But recently, in 2021, Marie Kondo had her third child. And like most of us, she had some trouble keeping up with all the stuff, right? She says that she's still sparking joy these days, but it now doesn't just hinge on having a tidy home. And I love this quote from her because people are like, aha, I knew no one could do that. And everybody's been sort of pouncing on her. But this quote from her was really redeeming. What she said is, tidying up doesn't mean... tidying up means dealing with all the things in your life. So what do you really want to put in order? What do you really want to put in order? With her, she's saying, yeah, look, I've got kids now, and dealing with them, I'm still going to clean, and I'm still going to do some other things, but that's not the biggest priority. What's most important that I put in order for her was her family. What do you really want to put in order? And that's a great question. Some of us would like to put our garages in order. Maybe you're like me and you've got stuff stowed in your garage that hasn't seen the light of day since the Reagan administration. Or maybe what you really want to get in order is your finances, and you don't know where all the money's going and where it's coming from and how it's getting. Maybe what you'd really like to get in order is your relationships. And there are people that you love that you've lost contact with, and there are relationships that are strained that you'd really like to set in order. Maybe what you'd really like to get in order is your community, because there are people in your community that you care about, but they're going without, or they're struggling in some way, and others who are taking advantage of them. And so you'd really like to get your community in order. We all have things that we'd like to get in order. But as we continue our study through the book of Deuteronomy, we're going to see that God places a similar demand on our lives. That we order our lives, but not according to our priorities or what we perceive to be most important, but according to His priorities. That we order our lives by God's priorities. And if you think about it, that's really what the Ten Commandments are all about. They are like Marie Kondo's list of how to organize your home. They're God's list of how to order our lives, how to organize our lives, how to put ourselves and our lives in order. And if you think about it, when you're going through here, we'll see that really God's list of what things ought to be put in order and where things ought to be are the exact opposite. The exact opposite of what we hear in culture. The exact opposite of what we think is important in our world. And it starts like, we're not even going to go through all the Ten Commandments today. We're just going to go through the first three, but we'll come back to that. We'll just start at the beginning here in Deuteronomy chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. Moses summoned all Israel and said, "Hear, Israel, the decrees and laws I declare in your hearing today, learn them and be sure to follow them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb." Now Horeb, if you don't remember, that's the mountain that Moses went up. He got the Ten Commandments. He brought them down. So that's Mount Horeb. The Lord God made a covenant with us at Horeb. It was not with our ancestors that the Lord made this covenant, but with us, with all of us who are alive here today. The Lord spoke to you face to face out of the fire on the mountain. Now, this is a really powerful opening. This is just before the Ten Commandments. But in order for it to make sense, we've got to understand the situation here. This is not the first generation of Israelites. This is not the generation that God went into Egypt and rescued out of slavery. This is not the generation that saw the 10 plagues. This is not the generation that came out of Egypt, out of Egyptian bondage, and God parted the Red Sea for. This is not the generation that followed the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud, and God led through the wilderness. This is not the generation that stood at the base of Mount Horeb when Moses went up and God spoke down out of the fire and brought forth the 10 Commandments. This is not the generation that God led to the Promised Land, who then proved faithless and said, "No, we can't go in there. They're too big. They're too strong. They're too mighty. They're too powerful. We can't do it." This is not that generation. This is their children and their grandchildren. This is that generation who has now come full circle, come back to the edge of the Promised Land, are about to go in, and Moses says to them, "It wasn't with our ancestors that God made this covenant. It was with you. It wasn't with them. It was with you. God spoke to you out of the fire at the base of that mountain. You were there," Moses says. So in other words, this is not literally true, right? Some of them might have been kids then, but they were certainly not adults then that with whom God made the covenant. They were just along for the ride. This is not poking holes in the biblical story, nor is this just remembering. What Moses is saying is that every generation has to go back there. Every subsequent generation will be transported back to their ancestors' day, in their imaginations, in their minds, going to be transported back to experience the Sinai event for themselves. They commit to that covenant themselves. It doesn't matter what your parents or your grandparents did there. What matters is, what are you going to do there? Are you going to commit yourself to the covenant? Because you are in some way linked to that past. You participate in the past. Isn't that a wild thought? You go back there and you shape the future by your decision that you make back there. You are linked to the past, and you provide that link for the next generation, for your children when they come after you. You take them back there as well so that they can participate in the story of God's creation of Israel. This is not about what your parents and grandparents did. This is about what you are going to do. And I know, I grew up in a Christian home. My parents were Christians. My grandparents were Christians. I'm so thankful for the legacy of faith, for all the investment that was made in my faith by the people who loved me. I cannot discount that. I don't think I would be standing here today were it not for all of their sacrifices and their love and their dedication to God and their dedication to me. I can't say that I would be standing here today. I very seriously doubt it. So I'm not discounting their faith at all. But in the end, their faith didn't matter. I had to make the choice for myself. I had to decide, who am I going to be? Because I cannot live on my parents' faith. I cannot live on my grandparents' faith. As great as their faith is, I cannot stand before the Lord God one day and say, God, I'm pretty good. Don't you remember how faithful my parents were? God, I ought to be saved. Don't you remember how faithful my grandparents were? God, I should be in good condition. I remember that my parents did all this work, all this sacrifice. They dedicated themselves to you. God's not going to be asking me about my parents' or grandparents' faith. He's going to be looking at our relationship. And that's exactly what Moses is telling this generation is, you've got to go back there for yourselves and decide who you're going to commit to. You've got to decide for yourselves who you're going to be. This covenant that he's talking about, it's not a dead word to a dead people. And that's what that generation is. That generation is dead now. It's not a dead word to a dead people. It is a living word for this living generation. These commandments are not timeless principles, which is sometimes how even we as Christians describe the Ten Commandments. They're not timeless principles that are dropped out of heaven and come down to everyone everywhere. These are God's words to his people, telling them how they ought to order their lives as God's people so they can live out in the world. This is God working out a covenant with each generation so that they know how to be a generation of his people. And this is what that covenant looks like. This is what the commands and the laws and the decrees, as Moses called them, this is what they look like. It says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. By the way, I am, that's, you know, the name of God, Yahweh. I am that I am when he was asked his name. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I'm a God who delivers you from slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, this is an NIV translation. Some of you may still have KJV running through your heads. Have no other gods beside me. Now, literally, that's the King James Version is probably a little more accurate here, because what he's actually saying is, you're not going to come into my presence with another God together. You can't have me and. You shall have no other gods beside me. No other gods are going to come into our presence, me and you, come into our presence together. And he goes on to say, you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Now, these are the first three commandments. And right off the bat, as we're thinking about ordering our lives, we see that these first three commandments are all about God himself. It is 100% about God. It's about his person. It's about his image. It's even about his name. He prohibits the worship of any other god, because when you worship any other god, when you believe in any other god, when you serve any other god, what you're saying is, God can't take care of all this. Yahweh can't take care of all this. I got to turn to someone else for some of this. So I'll serve God for the protection maybe that he provides from these other nations. He's been really good in battle. But when it comes to growing crops, when we finally get to a place where we can grow crops, I'm going to turn to the crop-growing God. I really believe God can provide, maybe. He's given us, you know, food, manna in the desert, and waters out of rocks. I mean, he's really been a good provider. But when it comes time for the health of my children, I'm going to pray to some other God who's really good with health. And God says, no, I am all sufficient. Worshiping and serving any other God is just a slap in his face. It's saying that Yahweh can't handle everything. He's not all-sufficient. But the thing is, God is all-sufficient. He can handle any and everything. So going off and trying to find protection or power or money or help in any other sphere, any other realm, it's an act of pure betrayal that wounds God. I mean, it's no different than a husband or wife betraying their spouse in the arms of another. It wounds God deeply that we would ever turn to another when he has committed, has promised, has covenanted himself to take care of all of our realms of life. God says, I'm taking care of all of it. You don't need to go anywhere else. I have promised to do that. In fact, God says, I'm so all-encompassing that he doesn't even want an image made of himself. Because images would easily allow Israel to confuse the Creator with the created. And think about it. What would you make an image of? If you were going to make an image to represent God, and you've got the whole world, you've got amazing artisans at your fingertips, and you're like, okay, I want to make an image of Yahweh God because he's amazing. What are you going to make an image of? Because whatever you choose, it's not going to be enough. You can make an image that gives God, say, attributes him to the power of weather. And God certainly is in charge of the mighty forces of nature, but he's in charge of so much more. You can make an image that depicts God as the God of the harvest, but God is so much more than the God of the harvest. The God of protection, but he's so much more than the God of protection. God is over every single realm, so anything you choose to make an image of God, even if you're saying, this is for Yahweh God, this is the God of the Ten Commandments, this is the God that I love, this is the God that I want to serve, I want to serve him, I just want to look at a picture of him or a carving of him or some sort of image of him, anything you choose is never going to be enough. And what happens is that then you end up limiting God. If you make an image of a God that looks like a shield because you think God is a great protector, then what happens is he just becomes the protector God and not the provider God, not the deliverer God, not the salvation God. He's just the protector God. So God says, don't even make an image of me. And if you're focusing on a single area of activity, you're limiting where else God is at work. Now, maybe at your point, you're thinking, okay, I am with you. I 100% agree. This all makes sense to me. We don't need to have any other God. We don't need to make an image of God. And then you get to that little phrase about God punishing to the third and fourth generations those who hate him. And you're like, wait a minute. Third and fourth generations? God, that's a little harsh. You're going to punish someone's great-grandkids for something their great-grandfather did? God, that's awfully harsh. But we're forgetting the way that they lived. They didn't live like you and me where, you know, I've got my family house with me and my wife and my kids. They had households that included grandparents and even great-grandparents. So when he says, I'll punish to the third and fourth generation, what he's talking about is when a household is led astray by their patriarch, by the one who rules their household, when he leads that family astray into sin and they start worshiping an idol of God or worshiping another God altogether, that entire family is paying for their own sins. Because when the leader of a household does that, it's not just them who's doing it. It's their entire household. Spouses, parents, children, grandchildren, they're all falling into this trap. So I'll punish to the third and fourth generations those who hate me, those who turn away from me, because the entire household has fallen into this sin. but to the thousand generations. Those who are faithful to a thousand generations. In other words, when you are unfaithful, it has grave consequences right here and now for you and your family, for you and your children, your parents, your grandchildren, whomever it may be. It has grave consequences right here and now. But when you are faithful, it pays dividends for eternity, a thousand generations. Not just you and your children and your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, but for a thousand generations, I will show love to you because of your great faithfulness. And then we get to talk about taking God's name in vain or as the NIV puts it, misusing God's name. And we tend to, when we hear that taking God's name in vain, we tend to have a very specific context. This is about just not saying God in an ugly way, you know, in profanity or just saying God's name in some offhand way. But again, it's about more than that because God's got a lot of names. Think about it. God's got a lot of names. There is the God who provides. There is Adonai. There's Yahweh, his personal private name. I mean, there's all these different names of God. Maybe you've even had a class or read a book that went through the names of God, all the different things that we call them. It's about taking God's reputation, his actions, and misrepresenting him. He's saying, you cannot use my name, my image, my likeness, my reputation to do something false or deceitful or even for empty purposes. You can't manipulate me and you can't use me to manipulate someone else. Does that make sense? Because how many times have we heard people who would get cornered say, I promise to God I didn't do that. I swear to God that's not true. And they'll use God's name as a tool to manipulate their way out of a situation. And you can see by this that God is specifically seeking to protect those who are vulnerable, who could be injured by oaths and promises made in God's name. Because when you are poor, when you are powerless, when you are weak, like a widow or an orphan in a vulnerable position, and someone else takes God's name against you and uses God's name as leverage against you, you've got no recourse. And God says, I won't have that. You can't use my name as a way to manipulate others and get your way. So don't take my name in vain. It is all about God. The first three commandments establish Israel's priority, and it's not so much about make God first, and then family second, and society third, and so on and so forth. That is not what this is at all. This is not place God first. God is first priority. It's that God is the priority. Everything else flows out of that. God is the priority. So for instance, next week we're going to talk about some of the other commandments like remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Well, you can set aside a day of the week and not do any work and say, therefore I kept the Sabbath. But if you're not doing that to honor God and in a way that's relational with God, it doesn't benefit you and doesn't benefit society, doesn't benefit your family. You can go around and say, well, I didn't murder anybody. Well, great, you didn't murder anybody. But there's more to not murdering than just managing to not kill your neighbor, right? Not committing adultery. God says everything else flows out of this. This is the priority. We tend to think of ourselves and our relationship to God in terms of priorities, but make God first and then everything else after. Usually we'll say family second, country third, or something along those lines. But that compartmentalizes our lives. Even if we give God the biggest percentage, God, you get 90% of me. We're still compartmentalizing our lives. Instead, God says, I don't want you to compartmentalize my life. You are my life, right? Your whole life is mine. Everything you do and everything you are, everything that's going to come after this, flows out of this exclusive relationship. As the people of God, we can no more separate God from our family, our work, or our civic duties, or the rest of our life, then we can separate our souls from our bodies. He is that inhabited. He is the life. And if you think about it, God lives and breathes and moves through us and every aspect of our lives and our relationships, and any attempt to separate God from these other parts of our lives, from our family life or from our work life, from our community life, it just leaves that part of our life cold and lifeless. When we take God out of our marriage or our parenthood or our relationship at work or our the work that we do itself, or when we take God out of how we live in our community or our state or our nation, when we take God out of that, we're removing the life from it. Now, this is not to say, and this is often where Christians get confused, that this is how, therefore, the United States needs to order their laws by the Ten Commandments. This is not, and would not work as a constitution for a country, because it was never about national boundaries and those sorts of things. This was 100% about people who were living in relationship with God. It's all about people living in relationship with God. This is for the people of God. I can't make someone who's not a Christian promise to put God first. I can't make someone who's an atheist follow God's decrees and commands. It doesn't make any sense. It can't make any sense. So this is not about Christians legislating this for non-believers. This is about Christians themselves making this commitment for themselves. Because the real temptation for us is to do that little compartmentalization and say, I'm going to trust God with all of my spiritual life, but I am darn sure going to trust the military with my protection. I'm going to trust God with taking care of the souls of my children, but I'm going to make sure I got money in the bank to take care of the groceries. I'm going to trust God with these aspects of my life, but I've got other things. I've got a great healthcare system to take care of our health, or I've got, you know, all these other tools at my disposal. And the hard part, especially for us today, is that some of these tools do have power. I mean, they absolutely do. If I've got money in my bank account or in my wallet, I can go and get food anytime I want. If I've got a good military, then I feel, you know, better about some other country or some other person attacking me or attacking my state, right? They absolutely do have some power. But God says, really? Really? We have all these tools, and yet we know how vulnerable we are. We have the best healthcare system in the world, and yet children get sick and die. We have the strongest military in the world, by far, far and away. We spend 20 times as much as everybody else put together. And yet, we watch the Twin Towers fall, if you're old enough to remember that. We have the strongest police force in the world, and yet we know the innocent are berated, and the guilty go unpunished oftentimes. So having all of these amazing tools, yeah, they're great. But ultimately, we have to come back to a trust in a God who never fails. A God who never lets us down. This is not God saying, don't bother working, don't bother taking care of your health. This is not God saying that. You do what you can do, but just know ultimately it's all about God. If God decrees your life His, 100% of your life belongs to Him. And we, like these Israelites, take that trip back to the base of Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. When we place ourselves in their shoes and we hear the voice of God promising to be our God, to deliver us from slavery, we have to ask ourselves, am I ready to commit to Him? That's the question we have to ask this morning. Is it worth being delivered from sin to give up the rest of your life? For those of us who are Christians, we have to answer with a resounding yes. But it should not be a decision that's made lightly or simply, because it is very costly. This morning, if you are ready to commit your life to God, to give God 100% of control of 100% of your life, God stands ready and waiting. He's ready to take your answer. And if we can pray for you, help you, assist you in any way, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?